Hi, I'm Mark Olson, and this is The Real, a podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I write about movies here at The Times, and a frequent topic of conversation among my colleagues on the entertainment staff is how tough it is for any of us to just keep up with the relentless wave of content between movies and TV. So this show is about the stuff that we're watching and how we watch it. The movie Roma has become one of the most talked about films of the season, both for its unusual release via Netflix and for the cultural conversations it has sparked. Directed, written, co-produced, and co-edited by Alfonso Cuarón, who also shot the movie himself as cinematographer, to say this is a labor of love is a wild understatement. Drawn from Cuarón's own childhood, growing up in Mexico City in the 1970s, the movie focuses on the experiences of an upper-middle-class family's live-in maid and nanny, Cleo, played by Yalitza Aparicio in her screen debut, as a way to confront class, privilege, and memory. Times arts and culture reporter Carolina Miranda recently toured the Roma neighborhood of Mexico City with Cuarón. They talked about the importance of the locations and its architecture to the movie's story, and even how it directly influenced the socio-political themes of the film as well. Carolina came by to talk about the movie and her time with Cuarón in Mexico City. Alfonso Cuarón's Roma has been one of the most talked about movies of both 2018 and I think moving into 2019. It's going to remain a movie that we're talking about quite a bit. And I'm joined today by Carolina Miranda, the LA Times arts and culture writer, making her debut here on The Real. I'm very excited to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you spent time with Alfonso Cuarón in Mexico City, walking through the very neighborhoods where he lived as a boy and where the movie itself is set and shot. So maybe just to get started, how did this story come about? How do you find yourself in Mexico City with Alfonso Cuarón?
A good deal of luck to start with. But I also think one of the things that always interests me about cinema as a non-film writer is always, and somebody who covers art and architecture, is how visual symbols, how architecture is used, how an urban landscape is used to tell a story. And I think I've written about Mexico City and its art scene and its architecture in the past. And when I saw that film, I was very interested in A, the period, the 1970s in Mexico, which was this very insular, very politically repressive era. And also, you know, the architecture that he depicts and the way that he employs it. And so I was very interested in the way he used Mexico City as a character, the way he used that house as a character. And that's how the story started. It was like, how can we talk about how all of Mexico kind of frames what you see in that story?
Is it rare for you to respond to a movie in that way? I don't know if you're always kind of like looking at the architecture, the production design, those kind of elements of a movie, or did it become immediately apparent to you that Roma was special in that regard, that it's operating on a different level in that way?
Well, I think I'm always watching movies with that lens. I always have an eye to those movies, and I'm always interested in how filmmakers use the urban landscape and use architecture to tell a story. I think I was particularly interested in this because of the way the house plays such an important role in the film. It is a character, the architecture of the house, like he dwells on certain aspects of the architecture in ways that really convey a sense of the story. So if you think about these very well-designed, aspirational spaces that the family inhabits in that house versus the space that the housekeepers inhabit. The family spaces are very aspirational. They're very modern. I mean, that the house that Cuarón grew up in was built in the 1930s, sort of like early modern era, post-Mexican Revolution architecture, a lot of art deco coming in. It's all very hopeful. It's all conveying these ideals of progress. Yet the housekeeper inhabits what is essentially this tiny little cell in the back of the patio with her colleague Adela that also is the place where they do the ironing and hang laundry. Like it's a workspace and domestic space. And they have to climb this rickety metal staircase to get down to the bathroom that is underneath. And then that's in comparison to this very graceful modern staircase that is the center of the family home. There's a number of shots that I think linger on that very beautiful foyer, that atrium, that when you enter the house, it just feels so airy and pleasant. And so to see how he used that to tell the story of this woman, this indigenous woman who is obviously from a poor rural area, who is living in a big city in this aspirational space, which she inhabits and she maintains, but it's not hers. It's never hers.
When you encounter Cuarón, when you meet him in Mexico City, did you feel that he had these thoughts himself? Like, did you feel that his ideas of what the architecture was doing, how did you find his thoughts on that and talking to him about this? What in some ways is like a very specific element of the movie.
I mean, he's very intentional. I don't think there's anything in that film that is not intentional. And when I asked him about the house, he was like, absolutely, the house is a character.
The house itself is some sort of a microcosm of society at large. Mm-hmm. The house is pretty much a character. It's a house that is pretty big, but still is a bit claustrophobic. That you have spaces also defined by hierarchy, you know?
Class.
You have, obviously, the upstairs, and you have downstairs and downstairs the kitchen.
Yes.
The kitchen happened to be the brightest place of the house.
And he discussed some really interesting things about the spaces in which Cleo, the lead character, is sort of allowed to be a character. That whenever she's in the rooms that belong to the family that she serves, her responses are always very limited. It's yes, it's no, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, you know, come along. You know, she's shepherding the kids out of the house. Whereas the only real conversations she has are when she leaves those spaces. And that was very intentional on his part. He and I talked about that. And I think the way he works with the visuals are so intentional that I had a hard time believing that any of this was an accident. You know what I mean? Like, I went back and watched the movie several times to prepare for the interview, but there's the scene where she's in the hotel room and there's a painting of a seascape, this roiling seascape behind her. Like, that was obviously not put there on accident. That harkens to the latter part of the film.
Do you find talking to him, a filmmaker, as you said before, you're used to talking to people from the art world, architects? How did you sort of approach each other? Like, was there a common language the two of you spoke to each other?
I think so, because I think to some degree, a filmmaker who is filming in places that are not sets, who is filming in real architecture on real streets, in real buildings, is thinking about space and how they are conveying space. And, you know, what do I do as an architecture and art writer, but think about space and how to convey it, how to represent it, thinking about what that space means. And so I think he was actually kind of pleasantly happy to speak to somebody who wasn't necessarily asking him questions that came from a filmic perspective, but really came in terms of dwelling on those ideas of what do these settings mean? What stories do they tell us? And I think for a filmmaker who doesn't necessarily, you know, he doesn't kill us with expository dialogue. I'm sure if you read the script to that film, probably half of it wouldn't make sense because so much of it is conveyed in these kind of quiet, abstract moments in which you're looking at a character's face or you're watching somebody move across the street, or you're watching her wash that patio in which nobody is saying anything and the action is quite limited. And so I think that for both of us, it ended up being a really interesting discussion because it was this real thinking about these spaces that we inhabit. They were designed with certain intentions. And so what are those intentions and how do you get them across on film? And he was very astute in terms of thinking about the class hierarchies that a house like that represented, what inhabiting a neighborhood like Roma, this very sort of comfortable middle-class Mexico City neighborhood for a woman that comes from a poor indigenous community. Like, what landscape is her life circumscribed to? So yeah, he's very intentional and very smart in terms of the way that he thinks about space. So I felt like we could have gone on and on. He had other interviews to do.
I know, I laugh at myself for using the phrase common language because I was so curious. Are the two of you having your conversation in English or in Spanish?
We had it mostly in English. We actually had a debate about that when we started because I was like, okay, English or Spanish? And he's like, well, what language are you going to be quoting me in? And I said, well, I'm going to write it in English. And he's like, well, then let's speak in English because then I don't have to translate. I can quote what he says. But then occasionally he would slip into Spanish if he felt he needed to explain a word or a concept that maybe he didn't have handy for English. So there was a little toggling back and forth.
And then you're on the actual street that he grew up on, but the building that we see in the movie is not the house that he grew up in. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I went there on my own after I interviewed him. The exterior that he used for the film is a house that was literally directly across the street from the house that he grew up in. And he ended up using that exterior because it had had less modifications made to it since the 1970s when he lived there. He still made numerous modifications. It was interesting to go to that street, which to a large degree is still evocative of, you know, this 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s architecture that would have been there when he was growing up. But like, for example, next to the house that he shot was like a modern, more contemporary house that was obviously built in the last decade, which he had to cover up for the purposes of the film. So this lane, this place where all of this life took place for him, like he wanted that space, those places to be in the film as well.
And then tell me a little bit about the neighborhood itself, of the neighborhood of Roma. It's interesting to me, in your story, you mentioned how it's now this kind of hipster enclave that is often mentioned in articles that have like Mexico City is the new Berlin.
Yeah.
And when you're on that street, what does it feel like? Do you feel like you're in Silver Lake, or do you feel like you're in some older place? Is there something transportive about even being in that location?
Well, Roma is very big. So I would say it is this interesting neighborhood in terms of the sort of Mexican historical context. The northern part is older and it has the bigger, broader avenues and it's a little bit more commercial. And I would say that's more where the hipster zone, all the restaurants and the little bars and art bookstores reside along Álvaro Obregón. The farther south you go, the sort of more neighborhoody it gets. You're in Mexico City. I mean, I feel like his street feels like it is not a hipster zone. I'd say that definitely that neighborhood has become more popular overall. In recent years, it was a neighborhood that was quite devastated by the 1985 earthquake. But since the late 1990s, it sort of started to make a comeback as people want to live closer to the center of Mexico City. You know, there are these like older modernist houses that are kind of these amazing spaces. You know, it's the same story, I think, of any urban center everywhere, of like younger people coming back to a place that older folks had started to leave. So the area he's in still feels very neighborhoody. You are in Mexico City, you are. And I mean, when I turned the corner and I saw the facade that he employed in the film, I knew right away where I was. Like, there's no mistaking it. But it is this very different place. And I think Mexico is a very different place. You know, it is a country that after decades of one party rule is more globally connected, is more open to different ideas. Just even in terms of Cuarón's own career, when he opened Y Tu Mamá También, it was right after a new government had taken over in Mexico, the first not to be part of the National Revolutionary Party in 70 years. This was 70 years of one party running everything in Mexico. And by everything, I mean everything. Culture, agriculture, food, banking, oil, like you name it, they ran. They had their hand in everything. And when he released Y Tu Mamá También in 2001, he had trouble getting a decent rating from the Mexican censors. A lot of people didn't want to show it because of the bad rating. Like, and I asked him about that. And he's like, oh, no, it's a very different world now. Sort of dealing with those kind of oppressive government bureaucracies has changed significantly. So it's not just this hipsterization, but I think it's a greater opening to ideas, a greater opening to the world, a greater exchange. Mexico has always been a cultural capital, but I think now there is just this exchange that's happening with the U.S. and Europe and other places that makes it really dynamic.
And now your story opens with you with Cuarón in a movie theater where it's featured in the movie. He himself saw movies there as a child. And then you say in the story that's where the Mexican premiere of Y Tu Mamá También was.
Yes.
I'm so interested in the sort of the dynamic for him sort of personally and emotionally of being in this spaces that mean something to him, like in the sense of memory. And that's a big part of what the movie is grappling with. And yet he's also there as a practical film location. He's like sort of bifurcated his own experiences of these places in this way that I don't know how you process that.
Yeah. I asked him about the shooting locations and he said, you know, that when he first set out to make the film, the goal was that he would shoot everything exactly where it happened. And he said that reality soon eliminated that plan because not every place that he had inhabited during that period existed or existed in its same form. Like, he didn't shoot in his own house.
This film, we were adamant of doing everything on location. Okay. We tried to do it in the marching orders at the beginning was that everything was going to be shot in the place where the actions took place. And then reality hit. Yeah, it reality beat us because
he ended up shooting in a neighborhood nearby, the house, the interior scenes, because all of the houses had been modified so much inside that they weren't the same. But I think the movie is about going to this emotional space of this period in time that meant a lot to him. And so I think that translates to the physical spaces in terms of going to places that have this real resonance for him and for Cleo, who's a stand-in for Liboria Rodriguez, the woman that helped raise Cuarón. And so Cuarón was just a devoted movie hound. as an adolescent. At one point, he had set this goal for himself that he would go see a movie in every cinema in Mexico City. So he ended up at the Metropolitan Theater. He ended up in many theaters. I think it was a way, a film for him. And I think for a lot of Mexicans at that time was this kind of cultural lifeline where you could see a lot of influences from the outside. And it was this cheap entertainment and escape. And so I think going back to the Metropolitan was for him going back to those feelings of going to these old movie houses. The Metropolitan is a movie house from 1943. It's very grand. Like the interiors are inspired by the Chapel of Versailles. There's a lot of marble and columns. And at one point, the columns next to the stage were like daubed in gold at the Capitol. I mean, it's one of those old movie houses where you went to have an experience. And for him, those movie houses were these places of imagination, of expectation. He talked about always wanting to arrive at the movie theater 10 to 15 minutes early so that he could see the raising of the curtain and the sense of expectation that comes with that curtain kind of like slowly climbing up. These were really important spaces to him. And I think it is no accident that we see more than one movie theater in Roma. Like these are really important. Movie theaters and movies were really important to him.
But also in your article, I found it really intriguing when you talk about there's a scene where the mother of the house takes the housekeeper to a hospital and the facade of the hospital. It's really impressive looking in the movie, but there's more to it that I think a lot of people, someone like myself, like wouldn't understand. Like, what is that facade?
That was a really interesting piece of archaeology because I went to visit that site in Mexico City, which still exists. It's a bas-relief at the medical center, which was built in the late 1950s. And at the time, it was like this apex of technology in Mexico City, this very modern functionalist building. And on the front of it, it had this huge bas-relief sort of at the entrance canopy that told the story of medicine in Mexico through the ages. You know, a lot of these big murals that are on buildings in Mexico City often relate some historical narrative related to the subject that the building is about. And so you go to the communications building and there's a series of murals that relate the history of communications dating back to the pre-Columbian era. And so that mural, it's a mural by Jose Chavez Morado, who is an important Mexican artist who did murals over at the National University in Mexico City. His works are held in the permanent collection at LACMA, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, very important early 20th century artist. And he'd done this huge concrete frieze, and the first two panels are these historical panels celebrating the feats of indigenous medicine, of pre-Columbian medicine and plants and all of those things. And, you know, like a lot of murals of the era, it's very venerative. You know, this is like Mexico. It's like so great. I couldn't go inside the hospital while I was there. But in the film, you go inside the hospital and it's this cavernous kind of industrial. This is not really a place you want to be having a baby. This giant room with women in labor and a lot of them poor women and indigenous women. And so this shell that tells the story in which the indigenous is celebrated, and then you go inside and it's the reality of what these women face in terms of what their government is going to give them. And I think for Cuarón, you know, he said at one point that one of the beefs he had always had with the ruling party was that it did employ these symbols, these indigenous symbols. It sort of put them on as a mantle, but that did not translate into actually supporting indigenous communities in practice. And I think that scene really tells that story, but without beating you over the head with it. You
know? Well, you have a fantastic quote from Cuarón in your story where he talks about how it's something he wanted to be sure to include in the movie is that tension between the way that the indigenous roots of Mexican culture are treated by the government and sort of the ruling party versus how the actual indigenous people are treated by that same government, by that same society. Tell me a little bit about maybe what he said about that and what your impressions are about that element of the movie. Because I think it's one of the trickier things, especially for American audiences trying to grapple with the movie, to understand.
It's interesting seeing the things that have been written about the film from an American perspective. I think one of those is exactly what you mentioned, that this is a country, much more so than the United States, that has a very strong indigenous presence and has always had it. It was a major, one of the world capitals of civilization at the time of the arrival of the Spanish. And those civilizations have not fared well. And I think the story of Cleo is a really interesting story because it tells the story of this woman who is in a society that theoretically venerates who she is, but look at how she's treated. Look at the spaces that she inhabits. Look at the little bit of personal time that she is allotted. A lot of these housekeepers, the live-in housekeepers in middle class and upper class families, you know, they live very isolated lives. Sure, they live in the nice neighborhood, in the nice house, but they occupy a little corner of it. They're not necessarily surrounded by the people that they know. Often their families are very far away. Often their roots are rural and very poor and indigenous and very different from this kind of European-dominated, fair-skinned upper class that runs everything in Mexico. It's this, the lives a lot of these women lead are very isolated, and they kind of occupy neither one world or the other. There's a great scene in the film in which they go to the hacienda for the party, and she descends into what is the worker party. You know, she leaves the main middle class party and she ends up at this worker party, and the woman says to her, it's like, oh, you're getting so big city, you don't want to hang out with us. So for these women, it's like, you know, they're inhabiting this cosmopolitan urban center, but they're not entirely a part of it, even as their identity is used to kind of celebrate Mexican history.
Well, it's so interesting, even for, especially for English-speaking audiences, if people are watching the movie on, say, for example, Netflix, how because the movie takes place in two different languages, neither of which are English, that the subtitles have to be done in different ways to sort of acknowledge that. And it's something that easily an English-speaking audience reading those subtitles could lose that element of the story entirely.
Oh, yeah. There's a great scene where Paco, who is the middle kid, who's a stand-in a little bit for Cuarón, who hears Cleo speaking Mixtec, and he's like, stop talking like that. Like, I don't understand you. And it's this complete denial of her existence in this very casual way that is also quite devastating in what a lot of indigenous people live with when they are inhabiting those circumstances, this complete denial often of who they are, this pressure to assimilate to the European.
Well, I think it's one of the boldest elements of what Cuarón is trying to do in the movie is that he is interrogating and grappling with his own privilege that he has enjoyed his whole life and that he maybe never even thought of what his housekeeper was going through when he was a boy. And that it's something, again, it's been interesting reading a lot of the writing that's coming out about the movie. How do you feel he does in dealing with that? Like, do you think he suitably and sort of with a clear-eyed sense of self grapples with that element of the movie?
I think he does. And he talks about how nerve-wracking it was for him to tackle this material because he's like, I want to pay tribute to her. I want to be honest. I also want to be respectful. It's not my story. But, you know, that's what filmmakers do is they make stories about people who are not them. And so he's like, I felt like I had to do it. I had to pay tribute. It's really interesting. I was listening to a podcast of him the other day. He was interviewed by somebody at the film school at the National Autonomous University in Mexico. And they were asking him about cinema and the tools of cinema, and he talked about how he always felt cinema is always compared to literature, but he feels it has a better comparison to music, that it's more abstract, that it's conveying sentiment in these ways that aren't always like literal narrative, expository narrative. And I think he does a really beautiful job in the film. You don't always hear a lot from Cleo about the inner workings of her life, but I feel like the inner workings of her life are revealed in these key scenes in which you can kind of tell what she's going through by just looking at her face. The scene where she's pregnant and they go to the medical center and the doctor is asking her all of these questions, you know, are you sexually active? How long have you had, you know, how long has it been since you've menstruated? Well, you know, these very kind of clinical questions. And it's this young woman reeling from this position she now finds herself in. And it's like, she doesn't want to answer the questions. And you just see in her face in this very intense scene, you know, this intense loneliness and fear and a sense of like, okay, I've really mucked things up. You know, she feels she can't go back home to see her mother because she's pregnant and she doesn't have a husband who's standing by her. And I think those scenes are the ones that are the most powerful and most powerfully convey that sense of isolation and in-betweenness that a woman like Cleo would inhabit.
Well, it's so interesting as well, the way in which the performances, both by Yalitza Aparicio as Cleo and then by Marina Di Tavira, who plays sort of the matriarch of the family, Cleo's boss, basically.
Yeah, Senora Sofia.
That the way in which the narrative reveals and allows them to build a dynamic, and that with Marina's role in particular, that she becomes a more sympathetic character as the movie goes along. I found that really intriguing, and it's something that I think would be really hard for Cuarón to sort of like get that dynamic just right.
It's interesting how this film, so interesting, it's about the lives of women, and he's a man, but I think he's sensitive. One of the things he told me is that thinking about that era, it was about thinking about this whole time in his life where he lived in this bubble and didn't have to think about any of these things, but that as he's gotten older and he's read more and he's spoken, he has spent hours on end speaking with Libo about her life, it is something that he has been munching on mentally for years. You know, he even says that this was a movie he wanted to make before Gravity, and it didn't quite happen. And he said, and I think part of it was that I didn't have the maturity to understand what they could have been going through.
What was it like to go back and kind of re-report her life in a way, to find out all of these things that were going on while you were a kid, but when you're a kid, you're not paying attention to them really, right? You're taking things for granted. You're living in your own kid bubble. So what was it like as an adult to go back and consider her life in this way?
Well, it was a whole reconsideration of not only of seeing all these layers of her, but inevitably the immense pain that it gave me, never have to stop to consider those things. And in someone that I love, taking things for granted. But ultimately, I guess that it's the same if you do an exploration into any person that you love. Your parents or whatever, you learn that there's a lot of stuff, other dimensions that you gave for granted, and because you're used to the presence and you have created dynamics throughout the years.
And there was a conversation that he had with Alejandro Iñárritu at the Directors Guild where he talks exactly about that, that it's like, I needed to have some gray hair before I could begin to understand and begin to kind of tell those stories. And these are two women that they lead very different lives, but there is the parallel narratives of, you know, they've both been abandoned by the men in their lives, left to their own devices. One obviously in much more comfortable setting than the other, and one with a subservient role to the other. You know, it's not by any means an equal relationship, but it's an interesting parallel that I think does make you feel, if at first Señora Sofia irritated you with how imperious she is with Cleo, at the end, you try to understand some of her inner complexities, not necessarily forgive the behavior, but I think understand it.
And there's a wonderful moment in your story when you're with Cuarón on the street and he gets recognized. It's funny. It's something that shouldn't seem that unusual, but for myself as like a person who spends time talking to filmmakers and with actors and actresses, you're usually in such a sort of a cloistered environment where the point is to stay away from interactions exactly like that one. What was it like for you to sort of witness him be recognized on the street like that?
Well, it was such an intense moment to be in Mexico City, period, because it was the week that Roma was premiering in Mexico City. So it was like posters everywhere, Yalitza Aparicio on magazine covers, Cuarón on magazine covers. Like, it was kind of this Roma moment. And then obviously everyone has been talking about this film since it first came out, you know, and it's his return to Mexico City. You know, the prodigal son comes back. It's about Mexico City. It's about Mexico City in the 70s. It channels these kind of obscure historical things that a lot of people don't know about internationally. And he is this really important figure in Mexico City right now. And as a result, he gets recognized a lot. And in fact, you know, our plan had been to kind of walk around the neighborhood and go to a cafe. And we just had to table that because I would have not been able to do an interview. Like, people kept coming up and asking him for selfies and telling him how proud they were. There was one man that came up and was like, oh, I was on blah, blah, blah block when you were shooting. And you know, he was like, what a great film. And I think people are really excited about it there. And there has been, I think, for the indigenous community, you know, a film that features an indigenous language that features Mixtec as part of, and a Mixtec character at its center is, you know, it's an important thing. It's not unimportant. I think whatever criticisms people might have about what they might see as the film's shortcoming, there are aspects of it that remain really important socially to Mexico at this moment.
Maybe as a way to sort of get to wrapping this up, I'm so taken with the idea of you kind of watching movies through this sort of architectural lens. So I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have a favorite architecture movie that you particularly like because of the way it handles its architecture?
One story I want to go back to. Last year, I did a story on the 10th anniversary of The Dark Knight and talked about how Christopher Nolan used architecture. Going back and looking at that film in the context of other Batman movies and other superhero movies with these very fantastical cities or very expressionist cities in which buildings have feature bizarre statuary and they're very big and they're very imposing. And the interesting thing about The Dark Knight is that he uses the Chicago landscape exactly as it is to tell this little bit of a horror show of a movie. And he uses a lot of like late corporate modern architecture, these kind of glassy, impersonal surfaces that tell the story of money and, you know, how is that money acquired and these kind of hidden machinations that go behind these accumulations of capital. And I think that is a really interesting film for being fantastical and using everyday architecture to tell that story of fantasy.
I hope that we get to have you back to talk more movies and architecture soon. Caroline Miranda, thank you so much for being here. Now tell folks where they can find your work online. Where are you on the Twitters?
Cmonsta, C-M-O-N-S-T-A-H.
And I am at Indie Focus. So for LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson. Thanks for listening.